Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Transit Authority, APTA's official podcast. I am Art Gazzetti, Vice President for Policy and Mobility at the American Public Transportation Association. Our guest for today's episode is my good friend, Lynn Peterson, author of the new book, Roadways for People, Rethinking Transportation Planning and Engineering. Lynn is currently serving as president of Oregon Metro Council. Lynn, thank you for joining us in today's podcast.
It's an honor. Thank you.
Lynn, thank you for your book and for the insight it brings at this critical time. The book covers several themes. We'll get into much of that in our conversation. But as I read it, the central focus is making sure the transportation projects that we plan and deliver are informed by the needs of the people in the communities that are intended to serve. Do I say that the way you would say it? And what? How might you elaborate on that premise?
No, I think you're exactly right, that every project should start with the needs of the community, not just the users of the roadway or the light rail or the high-speed rail that goes through the community. It is also about making sure that the context of these transportation projects is well understood and that we are not causing more harm through our investments, but actually increasing the amount of opportunity for all out of these projects, not just for a few.
There we go. Well, that's certainly the foundation upon which we should do our business. Another core theme is the need for transportation engineers, architects to adopt a more holistic view of what they do, holistic view of their work. The book points out that the role of transportation engineers is ever evolving, and transportation professionals need to change accordingly. You know, as we know, transportation touches every person in the community, and the projects that we plan should have outcomes, right? They should create. We're not talking about pouring concrete. We're talking about creating thriving, vibrant communities, build the character of places. I want to ask you about your vision. What's your vision of transportation's interconnected role with other city and community services?
Sure, that's a good question. One of my mentors, who was my boss when I worked 25 years ago as a staff planner at Oregon Metro, where I now serve as Metro Council president, asked me, when you see a roadway, are you actually in the roadway or are you looking at the roadway? In other words, transportation connects places. And if you're looking from an engineer standpoint, which is what I am, trained at the beginning of my career and worked for Wisconsin Department of Transportation for the first 5 to 6 years of my career, I would say I was sitting in the road, looking at the road and only at how the road was moving. Right? How the vehicles were moving. And if you change your perspective and you look at how you access the road from the land side of things, suddenly you can change your perspective of, are you a principal at a elementary school and your kids have to walk home or they have to access the bus? Now I'm looking at the roadway as either a hindrance, a negative, right, in terms of safety, or I'm looking at it as a way to access other opportunities. And my kids, as they walk home, get to play at the park and they get to cross the road safely to get to that park. Access is everything. Access to opportunities, access to healthcare, access to jobs, access to safe places to live, work, and play. So everything needs access from transportation, right? Whether it's your healthcare or your job. And so I think that's really the interconnectedness that we need to start looking at. Is that when we do a transportation project, are people going to be able to access what they need to access safely? And when we're also looking at these corridors, is there enough places of affordable housing, parks, opportunities for jobs? All of that is encompassed in our investments. Either we are increasing those or we're having a negative impact on that economic growth.
Interesting, Lynn. I mean, you make this connection. When you ask the public what they want, the outcome is going to be this more sort of community-friendly streets that are walkable, that you can actually be part of your life rather than to see cars whisk by. DOT, the current DOT, is putting big emphasis on sort of their safe streets initiative. Interesting. You come to the same conclusion, but you say when you ask the public and involve the public in decision making, that's the kind of outcome.
Yeah, outcomes for somebody in their daily life are much different than the transportation engineer. So if I go back to my training as an engineer, I feel like I only had 4 performance metrics that were asked of me to succeed upon, right? The first one was in design. We needed to make sure, and we still have these performance metrics on our engineers, that we decrease delay and increase safety for the vehicle user. Now, a lot of folks will say, well, we're doing better, and we are doing better, but that's the basic 2 performance metrics when we're designing for a roadway. And there are so many other performance metrics on that design that the community has, including their own personal safety or their kids' safety as they are using that facility by other modes other than vehicles. And then, of course, in construction, it was the other 2 performance metrics were only on time, under budget. And so those were my 4 metrics that I felt like in engineering that I was being held to. In planning, it was to the rational planning process. Did you go through a rational planning process? That rational planning process seems pretty linear and it seems pretty easy, and the outcomes are still to the project outcomes. If you aren't defining the project outcomes as community-based outcomes, only about moving vehicles faster, safer, then you are not actually getting to the detail that the communities feel that they need in order to be able to, again, thrive. So the performance metrics that we have in both sets of planning and engineering actually don't match the system-wide approach that people see their lives.
And Lynn, in your book, you did it very gracefully, but you do challenge the traditional training and mindset of engineers. I think it starts perhaps in engineering school. Is that changing at all? Is there a reform effort underway? Is it painfully slow? How might you say the way engineers are trained to have that more holistic view?
Yeah, well, you know, I haven't been in school for 30 years now, but I do believe that there is a bit of change happening. And I think it's coming from the students themselves who want to know more, that these 4 standard, you know, performance metrics aren't enough. And the public is demanding more. I think it just depends on whether you sit in a city or county or state DOT as to whether you're expanding those performance metrics and at the rate you're expanding those performance metrics, because systematic racism is built into both of those. In other words, on all of this, if I don't have the data, I can't measure it, I don't count it. So any of your lived experience in the community or on the roadway or accessing the roadway as a business, folks might, is not regarded as important as that which we can measure. And if we haven't even taken the time to start measuring it, we have already made a priority about what it is that we are trying to improve. We have narrowed the scope before we can have the full discussion about what the community needs are. So I would say there's a lot of work to try and gather more data, but in the absence of data, we need to use as much lived experience as we possibly can and get really detailed information from the community about how they see and how they perceive their safety. Otherwise, you know, we wouldn't, for instance, in our transportation ballot measure that we had put together, if we hadn't gone straight down into the community to have these discussions, the 5,000 streetlights that we had proposed to be put up in 13 corridors would not have actually done what we had hoped to do, which was increase safety for pedestrians, because they were in mostly BIPOC community, Black, Indigenous, people of color communities, where their skin was darker, and the light that's being used currently in our streetlights does not actually illuminate darker skin as effectively as other types of light spectrums that can be used. So if we hadn't done that detailed work, we would not have actually increased safety, even though we put the lights up.
Yes. Well, and Lynn, you do a very thoughtful dive into the troubled legacy of urban planning and transportation planning, too often characterized by decisions and actions that divided, weakened, and even destroyed communities. And most of that has happened in minority and low-income neighborhoods. That is discussed in other books, Jane Jacobs, The Wealth of Cities, Robert Caro, The Power Broker, and now Lynn Peterson in Roadways for People. First, I'd like to ask, how might we reckon with that? There is some fixing that needs done. Your book gives examples. So can you touch on that?
Well, I think when we think about these things, we should really look at a type of tool that was used in the past, and that was urban renewal and the basic idea of going in and pushing these projects through communities that we call blighted. And when we called them blighted, even though they were functioning, thriving, economically, culturally thriving communities, we devalued the land by calling it blighted. And then others were able to come in and either, you know, put in a roadway project, even hospitals have been, you know, put in to communities by displacing blighted neighborhoods or stadiums or convention centers. And all of that happened in Portland in one area. That's why I use those examples. But the entire community was called blighted in order to use urban renewal to be able to buy at a lower cost, essentially. And when we did things like that, we were not thinking about the long-term impacts, the intergenerational lack of wealth creation that we were then creating over time, and that cumulative impact to those families over time, not just those that were displaced by the actual project, but those that have been displaced by the gentrification. So I'd say the first thing is that when we as planners and engineers see a problem within the transportation system, what we usually do is scope a project too narrowly to begin with. And sometimes the scope is defined 20, 30 years before the project is even built. And we're only looking at a transportation asset. We're not looking at it through a community lens. And in order to think about how do we actually invest in the community while we are dealing with a transportation system issue, we need to go out and talk to the community and find out what's working and what's not working first. And not just start with for instance, and we've all seen it in our metropolitan transportation improvement programs or our state transportation improvement programs. We've all seen where it's one sentence that says, decrease congestion at X interchange by widening the highway by one lane in each direction. 30 years ago, we might have scoped that. 20 years ago, we might have scoped that. But there's a much larger system issue within our transportation system than just that. And so if we go into a community, we are not actually starting from a place of trust by telling them, this is the problem, here's our solution, what are the impacts? You let us know what the impacts are and, you know, we'll document those. You have to start from the place of what's going on here? What's going on in the community? What's working and what's not working? Are we going to isolate? Are we going to connect? We need to ask these questions of ourselves first. And it's a place from community building, not from a transportation asset issue. When we start from that spot, we are immediately going to lose trust with the community. And that's usually where most projects go wrong.
Hearing you say that, Lynn, I'm wondering, when did the spark for this book happen? Is it something, because you do talk in your book about your experiences early on, but then I'm thinking they built over time. When did you know you were going to write a book like this?
About 5 years ago, I'd say. I think what the opportunity to lead the Washington Department of Transportation has shown me that it doesn't matter whether it's a small project or a large project, the risk management of a project really depends on whether you start with a community-based approach and understand a systems analysis of the context that you're working in. Because as at the beginning of a project is when you have all the time in the world, essentially, to really figure out what the problem statement is and get buy-in from a diverse set of voices and perspectives on what that problem statement is. It doesn't matter whether you go back to why I left engineering and started on a journey to try and figure out where in the decision-making process I could have the most positive impact on building community rather than destroying community, which was a project in Wisconsin called Highway 12 that was initiated because we got a new Secretary of Transportation. And that new Secretary of Transportation decided with no conversation with the public, no conversation even with the regional directors, no conversation with their traffic engineer, which was me, that it was a safety corridor that should be widened and straightened for 70 miles between Madison, Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Dells, where most of northern Chicago and southern Wisconsin went to play the water parks and the casino and basically hunting up in that area. So he decided we need another access, even though I-90 went straight from Chicago to the Wisconsin Dells right past Madison. So it was an interesting decision that came out of nowhere. And when I, as a traffic engineer for the region, had to do the safety analysis, then it became clear to me that the problem statement wasn't well developed, because the majority of the fatals, which I was asked to do a fatals analysis, the majority of them were DUI related. So widening and straightening the highways doesn't necessarily make for a safer usage. And it was going to have a giant footprint where it only had a small footprint before. And so every farm owner, every farmer for 70 miles created a plywood sign that basically said the DOT was the devil. So between a conservation ethic and my own engineering safety of I can't control for DUI, right? Led me to start down this path of when do things start to go wrong? And it's from the very beginning. If you don't set the tone that you are there to be collaborative, say with the farmers, right, in the Highway 12 or in the middle of an urban area with the communities, especially and including BIPOC communities, if you're not there to engage with them and establish that trust and try and figure out the balance so that everybody can see that this investment will help, not just hurt them, then we are risking a lot of taxpayer money because the project could never happen. Nothing could happen. Or it gets delayed for 10, 20 years, such as Highway 12 did.
And Lynn, speaking of some of the perhaps more urban-oriented projects, of course, the outcomes are more community-based in a broad way, but a lot of the chapters of the book are focused on highway projects, of course, rightfully, because we have to do them better and do them right and end up in more holistic community-oriented outcomes. Transit is mentioned and implicit throughout the book, and I know it's very much in your DNA. Is the voice of the transit user represented in the community involvement process for road projects, if you're considering that? The outcome, of course, over the years has been too many auto-centric communities has been the outcome, which are designed to be counter to affordability goals, urban vitality goals, et cetera. So I'm just wondering, as a transit advocate, admittedly, what can we say about transit and transit's presence?
It's one of the reasons I wrote the book is because we don't have enough discussion, whether it's a highway project or a arterial or a commercial boulevard. It doesn't matter what the type of roadway is. We should be considering every single one of them as an integrated mobility corridor. That's one of the old FHWA ways of putting, right, this idea, the concept that you need to move people. The question is, how much capacity do you have in every mode? And is it safe for every mode to actually reach its full capacity? If you can't walk to the bus stop on a really high volume, high speed corridor, if you cannot walk to that bus stop safely, you're not going to do it. And now you have an isolated community, right? So yes, I think transit, bike, ped, obviously on an interstate, we can't really do bike ped access to the roadway segment, but we can do it to the interchanges. And I know my predecessor and friend, Washington DOT, Roger Millar, who's the new secretary, well, he's been there for quite some time. He put it in a really good way, is that we end up as highway engineers creating interchanges that are essentially islands, right? We don't connect anybody to anything on either side because it's just not safe. So if we've not created an interchange on an interstate that connects people on both sides, we have isolated community away from their opportunities.
Lynn, I'd like to bring up the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. You know, one way to view it is it's a transformative opportunity to do things differently, provide balance in our transportation system. You mentioned other things like the Reconnecting Communities pilot program designed to reconnect and repair communities that were destroyed by the mid-century urban highway expansions. You know, what are the keys to implementing the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act in ways that will have the greatest impact?
Yeah, I think that obviously starts from the beginning with the tone of what are we trying to achieve? Is this just a transportation asset management issue? Is it just about, say, the Baltimore Tunnel of the Northeast Corridor that we talked about in the book, where it was 150 years old and there were safety issues in the tunnel? Or is it about achieving more for the community along the 457 miles? Now, the segment that they were looking at wasn't 457 miles, but a railroad, just like any road, goes through a lot of different communities. And this tunnel, the mileage in the segment would have impacted with an improvement, right? An improvement or an investment to improve the safety would have had massive impact on the neighborhood between making it even less connected than it already was by the initial 150-year-old line, but also it would have displaced more people through the investments. It would have taken up a lot of community gardens, things that the community actually valued. Instead of reconnecting or making more opportunities for community gardens, recognizing what that community values, what they need in order to succeed because they were a food desert, recognizing these things at the very beginning and doing it in collaboration and empowering people. Because what I have found in my mentor in this, John Fregonese, who did many, many, many regional plans throughout the United States, would basically say you have to trust people. That if you start with values, you talk about the outcomes, you will essentially get ownership in a vision, in a plan that will improve everybody's ability to see that this place will thrive after the investment is made. So starting off on the right foot with the tone of you're not there to just do a transportation asset management project. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is to build that trust, because you're not going to have it straight up. And I think we should recognize that we are not going to have the community's trust straight up, because we have so misplaced our trust in the community by not starting out these conversations with them. We have decided what the problem statement was and then have gone in with a solution and then told them this was based on, quote, our expertise. This was the right solution for this transportation asset. And then basically, because we don't have the numbers, we weren't collecting the information, we don't recognize their lived experience, they ask us to start looking at things. We give them town halls, we give them opportunities to provide comment, and then we never reflect that back. And when we don't reflect that back, they know they aren't being heard, and the project starts to stagnate and even, you know, die because of the unrest within the community. So I would just say you have to show, in order to succeed, especially in this Reconnecting Communities pilot program, that you started off with the right tone, that you have found a way to build trust, and that trust is built by going out and getting the actual lived experience information in, right, with folks that are community liaisons that look and, you know, talk the language of the communities that you're working with, and that's done in safe places. And then that information is used to actually inform some scenarios, right? And that you have a committee that's actually empowered to help you make decisions along the way in order for it to reflect what the community's needs are, and that you aren't setting aside the things that aren't about transportation, like affordable housing, like healthcare, like parks, like the community garden. You don't set that aside. You bring in your other agencies that have, at the state level, at the federal level, that have the ability to bring the whole community up while you're making this transportation investment with an affordable housing project by preserving affordable housing, right? So you're actually acknowledging that there has been past harm and that this project is just an instigator to be able to seed more work within the community and basically repair the damage that was done prior and seed better efforts to make sure we're creating that intergenerational wealth, not just through the use of DBEs, although that's good on a project, but through community benefits agreements where you make sure that the local community is represented in the project labor, right? That you're 2, 3, 4 years in advance that you're working to build up that capacity within the community to actually participate in these projects, either through community-based organizations or the labor workforce. And that we start really thinking not just about using disadvantaged business enterprise minority contractors for subcontracting, but we actually start building up contractors to be able to participate as full contractors on a project and be able to make the connections between that labor workforce and the project and the subcontractors and build them up. So it's one ecosystem, and we're not, through our procurement, not allowing that growth to happen from, you know, a $2 million limit of work above that. We really need to do more on that entire continuum in order to build that trust to be able to get up.
Working very closely with the Equity in Infrastructure Initiative, and we certainly fully endorse that and applaud it. And some of the techniques and guidelines you just referenced, we'll talk about more in the second half of our podcast. I'd like to close and the first part, and before we take a short break, invite you to offer your perspective on some of the mobility trends at this point in time. You know, how can the transit position community itself among those trends, you know, notably remote work trends, shifting travel patterns? Any comment on how the transit can best position itself?
You know, transit is obviously, transit providers across the country are facing an uphill battle coming out of COVID. I think users are slowly coming back as people go back to work, even if it's 2 or 3 days a week. So that's good. I think we're going to need to recognize that information that we have from the past can inform the future. And we do know that when people work from home a couple days a week or more, that they still have the same number of trips per day. And right now, many of our transit service hours are provided in the peak. But if you're at home, working from home, you still are going to make connections during the day for lunch. You're going to go out to lunch. You're going to make some more trips in terms of maybe errands that you were unable to make. So there's the trip making is still there. It's just happening at different times of day. And it's going to be more level and even throughout the day as we go through. It'll be more congested. You won't have these large peaks in the peak hour like we used to. So I think we need to think about that. And also the fact that the importance of downtown is shifting, and we need to figure out how we connect all of our economic centers, not just to downtown, because our major metropolitan areas have way more than one economic center. And while we want to keep our downtowns thriving, there are many, many little downtowns that have the capacity to grow, but they need the connection, and they need it more than just during a commute period for 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours at night.
Yeah, certainly something we need to do. Let's take a moment for a short break and then rejoin our guest, Lynn Peterson.
Register today for APTA's 2023 Rail Conference in Pittsburgh from June 11th through the 14th. Join your industry colleagues at the Rail Conference and address the critical priorities and challenges facing all rail modes: urban, commuter, high speed, and intercity. Experience the latest industry advances at the Products and Services Showcase and join the Pittsburgh Regional Transit Technical Tours. Make your plans now to attend APTA's 2023 Rail Conference presented by HNTB. Find out more and register today at APTA.com.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to our podcast. I am Art Gazzetti, and I'm joined by Lynn Peterson, author of the book, Roadways for People, Rethinking Transportation Planning and Engineering. Lynn, for the second part of our conversation, I'm going to get into more specific guidelines that you suggest for outcomes-focused transportation planning and project implementation. Your book gives some good examples of where transportation projects miss the mark by not being in touch with community needs. In what ways did projects like Portland's I-5 Rose Corridor Improvement Project and other projects noted in your book come up short?
Well, the Rose Corridor Project on I-5 is similar to other major metropolitan areas where an interstate came in through. It could have gone many different places, but the route that was chosen was straight through the Black community of North Northeast Portland. The specific neighborhood, Albina, has been ravaged over the years by not just an interstate, but also a stadium, a coliseum, a convention center, a hospital. All of these things displaced residents and caused a lack of connectivity from one side of the interstate to the other side, as well as any of the impacts of isolation in terms of being able to get to jobs and health impacts from air quality. So all of those things cumulatively have impacted that community over the years. And, you know, it's in the most urban part of our east side. I-5, there is two lanes in each direction. We have a policy in the region that no interstate shall be above three lanes in each direction. The Department of Transportation came in and wanted to do an auxiliary lane through this interchange, the Rose Corridor interchange. And the Rose Corridor is where the Blazers play, so it's an events area, right? And they wanted to add an aux lane. In order to add the aux lane, they recognized that the surface streets needed to be connected. And to do a better connection, they felt that they could do a lid on top of this area instead of several different bridges. And they went ahead and they did an environmental assessment. So they had defined the problem without community involvement. They had defined the solution without community involvement. And then they, in my opinion, chose a shortcut. And this is where a lot of projects go wrong. They choose the environmental assessment because, oh, we're all within our own right of way. We will not have any more impact than that. And so we will not significantly impact. So they've made a decision that they will not significantly impact prior to talking to anybody. So problem statement, no engagement. Solution, no engagement. And then a shortcut is taken where there is no limited need to go out and talk to the public. There is so much distrust in these communities because of the cumulative impacts of decisions over the years that this was just one more bad decision and there was a lot of rancor. Instead of looking at it from a community perspective, which is how could we have used that lid to actually reconnect that which was disconnected. And by building a lid, you could say, well, that's an incredible step up from just a bridge or two. You're going to have better bike and ped connections. But the way it had been designed, that lid, it was actually increasing dead space again within the community and not increasing the economic ability to connect one side to another. And it also, the entire project did not have any commitment to rebuilding intergenerational wealth in the community at the time that the project started to go sideways. There was a bit of DBE commitment, but there was not a commitment beyond that. And intergenerational wealth can be created through getting folks jobs on projects such as this and getting them through apprenticeship and into journeyman work. But there is also a parallel project happening at the same time, which called the Albina Vision Trust. And the entire, you know, there was a part of the community that was actually looking to bring back folks to live into this area that had become an event center and create intergenerational wealth by creating places for small businesses, creating opportunities for development from Black contractors or minority contractors, minority-owned contractors, through all these different methods. And the DOT chose to focus only on one when there were so many more ways that they could help. And so that project is actually, I'd say, 80% back on track because it was stopped and had to basically restart over. And we got the governor involved in order to get more direction to the DOT, basically on their problem statement of what was the state trying to achieve in this area. It wasn't just a transportation, you know, asset management issue with a traffic flow problem on the interstate. It was actually an interchange problem that had created all of this mess in the first place in the neighborhoods. You know, changing that problem statement literally required a lot of time and resources to go back and redefine, including a lot of political capital from a lot of electeds to say, time out, time out. You can't start with this problem statement. And because you took the shortcut and because you got your environmental assessment approved by FHWA doesn't mean that it's the right problem statement with the right solution.
Lynn, I'm going to come back to successful public involvement in a minute.
Let's talk about that.
You mentioned the Albina Vision Trust. And I'd like to ask about trusted voices. You know, how community involvement perhaps hasn't been done well in the past, for example, but new things, new ways of doing it that are making it so much better, right? Engaging community members who would not typically be involved in transportation planning process. Your book mentions things like providing babysitters, providing meals, going door to door to get people engaged, compensating people for their time, and bringing trusted voices into the discussion. Comment on that.
Yeah, those are all good ways. And I think a lot of communities are going above and beyond that now. I think that was the initial set of ideas that were on the table 5 to 8 years ago. And now folks are understanding that they can partner with community-based organizations to even get more information on a continuous basis and provide leadership within the communities. So, you know, Metro, Oregon Metro, when we did our transportation ballot measure, we spent 2 years giving out grants to community-based organization, whether that be the Asian Pacific Islanders, whether that be the Latino community-based organizations. We spent a lot of grant money bringing them up to the ability to have the capacity to understand the transportation world and how to interpret it, how to use plain language. And once they had that capacity, they were then able to actually respond to RFPs, requests for proposals for community engagement. So the CBOs were actually able to do the work in community on the transportation measure, going that one step further. And even with that, what we have seen is the empowerment then of thought leaders within the community to be able to be part of the process, not just part of the process for a project or a program creation that benefits their community, but then to get elected. We now have 3 out of the 7 metro councilors, or 6 metro councilors, that actually came from our work with community-based organizations in getting them the necessary capacity to be able to be part of this. And they got so excited, they ran for office.
No, there's a good story and a good outcome. Lynn, you mentioned in your book, have a chapter on it, the Eagle County, Colorado, and you know, community input and collaboration that helped make a difference in their coordinated transportation and mobility project. Can you hit the key point there? What made that happen?
Well, Eagle County is a very much a resort-focused town, with Vail being in the center of it. It is extremely unaffordable to the working class, although it is obviously served by a lot of service jobs. 29% of the population in Eagle County identifies as Latino, but the number of people living in poverty as Latinos is double the white residents. And what they were finding is that on the transit side of things, the bus riders were earning less, well, 50 to 60% of them were earning less than $30,000 a year. And they had a steep curve in terms of using the transit service because it's such an auto-dependent area. So the chief culture officer for the county, Angelo Fernandez, had started a lot of work on building collaboration between county departments and external agencies such as nonprofit hospitals to basically define what were the needs in the community for those who were at this poverty level. And he said that the strings that pull through all of their work were equity, and that accessibility is about opportunity. So when they started talking to all of these different agencies and nonprofits, they found that the messaging about the availability of the transit service was not actually getting out to the people who needed it the most. So they worked to define, okay, so what's going on with each of our transit agencies? And each one was using a different scheduling system that you had to access each one individually. And there was no way to figure out between the county and the different city services how to actually use the system, and it wasn't necessarily in different languages. So they created one app to be used throughout the entire county that pulled all of this information together and in the languages that were necessary within the community. And it was more visually based, so it was easy to understand. And it could be used offline because most of these users actually can't afford, you know, to connect. So they were able to download it when they had Wi-Fi and then use it offline. So they were able to connect people to services. They were able to build trust, and they were able to really get the professionals to understand that they needed strong roots to their professional ethics in order to get to different conclusions. And I think there's even more good work in the Eagle County that was included in our book in the story about how they connected health and transit access and acknowledged the entirety of racial equity and performance measures, including affordable housing, behavioral health, daycare, substance abuse, way beyond transport measures. And I think that's where, really, that's where we're headed in the future, is these overarching community performance metrics and how projects, it doesn't matter what part of an agency you're in, how do they help benefit the whole of somebody's life and not just a small part or have a negative impact on it?
Awesome. That's certainly, we need metrics that measure real value, and that's what transportation should do and contribute to. Lynn, your book offers a thorough description of various techniques that we want to commend to the readers. You know, things like context-sensitive design, performance-based practical design, demand management, least cost planning. We don't have time to go in depth there, but what does the audience should know? What do you want them to know about those?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at there, is that we have different ways in which to solve problems, and we don't always use all the tools in our toolbox. Most of the time, we go to the one tool that's in our standards book, and standards are just guidelines. They are not the everything, as we have been taught to believe. So context-sensitive design, obviously coming out of the 1990s, was a way to acknowledge the different land uses that were around your roadway, and then have a conversation about how the roadway should interact with those different land uses. Should the lane widths be 14 feet, or should they actually be 10 feet because you've got a high density environment going on and you want to make more room for other modes or a different way to park or not park on that roadway, right? Different access standards. Performance-based practical design is about basically teaching engineers that you don't have to go to the perfect and the standards in order to get a safe and accessible roadway. And you should probably look to see if there's something cheap that you can do immediately rather than waiting for the future for the perfect, right? And I think a lot of folks in our field feel like they need to wait for the $25 million new interchange to get improved safety, when in reality, we could get 80% of the safety fixed sometimes, or even 10% fixed just by restriping. And if we would just go out and do these small things, we would save money and we would start saving lives immediately rather than waiting. I'll just end with demand management. A lot of the times, that solution of how to manage the demand for our roadways before we expand is never pursued. We just look at adding roadway capacity as the first way, and we need to look at it as the last. And so how do you design roads for that integrated corridor management that we just talked about earlier? That's really what demand management is, looking at the capacity of all of your modes and are they optimized, or all of your modes so that they are optimized.
Lynn, we talk about sort of the heart of your book gets into community solutions-based approaches, project teams, community benefits agreements, and then you go into how they were specifically applied to a couple projects, the Northeast Corridor Tunnel Replacement Project in the city of Baltimore and the Claiborne Avenue Project in New Orleans. How were those used effectively?
Yeah, and the Northeast Corridor Tunnel Replacement Project, I mean, it didn't start off on the best foot, and Veronica McBeth at the Baltimore DOT at that time recognized, and they were not on a path to actually make improvements in the community at the same time, and changed, as I said, the tone, looked at the problem statement a little differently, got everybody agreed as to what they were trying to achieve within that corridor that was more than just the transportation asset upgrade, and put in place a committee to guide them through the process, as well as hired community liaisons to go door to door to get that lived experience input. There was a lot more there, I'm sure, but I think those were some of the key things. And again, it's about getting ownership from a diverse set of perspectives on the problem statement, and then looking at scenarios, which is how they ended up talking with the neighborhood about that would have been affected in depth about how to minimize those impacts and what set of solutions in each of these scenarios would actually maximize for a whole bunch of performance metrics other than just the safety in the tunnel. The Claiborne Avenue project in New Orleans, Claiborne Avenue used to be heart and soul of the Black community there, cultural venues up and down. It was a beautiful strolling neighborhood, and the street was a beautiful street line boulevard, and then a bridge came down and they basically wiped out the cultural heart of the neighborhood, along with any aesthetics of wanting to be there that were originally there. And so they actually started that project with the right tone, that they knew and had talked to the neighborhood, and there had been a lot of talk for a very long time about removing and redesigning this bridgehead, where it landed, how it landed, what the street design would look like, and tried to revision it. But the community was also extremely practical and said, we don't know if and when we're ever going to get money for this project. So we'd like to talk about two things. We'd like to talk about what does it look like in the future, but we'd also like to talk about the here and now and how to make it better. Because again, this project divided the community and created a lack of connectivity and eyesore. And because it, you know, was originally called a blighted area, it was left that way, and an investment had passed it by. So they were looking at how to use the space under the existing elevated structure and between murals and activities, how could they liven that up and make it a valuable asset instead of a negative until it was actually replaced. And both projects seem to be moving forward in the federal system in order to find money, which is encouraging.
Lynn, before we wrap things up, are there any other messages in the book you would like to mention or underscore?
You know, I think this is all about being an effective change maker. It's about the leadership within transportation engineering and planning, and how can you be an effective change maker? And I have always believed that that collaboration comes by acknowledging those values, by being able to define the outcomes that we all want, and then find actions that we can all agree on through that solution, that we remain curious throughout our entire careers and we never assume. And I guess that's where I'd just like to leave it. This whole book, the whole last part of the book is about, you can make an assumption, but you have to test and retest and retest your assumptions to make sure that you're actually benefiting everybody as you move a project or program or policy through. It is about assuming that you're wrong. You can't assume that you know everything. As an engineer, I was trained in material science, right? I know when asphalt and concrete are going to fail. That does not mean I know everything about a community and what the community needs are, or a user of a transit or a user of a highway. We need to delve deeper. We have to be curious, and we need to not assume, because we all know what happens when we assume.
Well said. Lynn, final question. I thoroughly enjoyed reading your book and recommend it to anyone looking to better understand community involvement and how it makes our transportation better. Question, how can people get a copy?
Oh, good question. You can go to Island Press and order it there, or you can go to my website, lynnpetersonconsulting.com, and get to a whole host of different ways to buy it.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us for this episode of The Transit Authority, AFTA's official podcast. We thank Lynn Peterson for being with us today to discuss her new book, Roadways for People, Rethinking Transportation Planning and Engineering.